In the late 1800s, the legendary Mark Twain was in the middle of a world tour. He told this story. A man ought to know himself early. The earlier, the better. He ought to find out how far he can go and how much bravery there is in him and when to stop, not overstrain. I had the good fortune to learn the limit of my personal courage when I was only 13. My father at the time was a magistrate in Hannibal, Missouri. My father was also the town coroner and kept a small bird coop size office at home. It also had a small sofa. Often, when I was on my way to school, Twain said, I would notice that the sky was threatening, that it was not good weather for school. I was very likely to get wet. So I thought I'd better go fishing. So I went fishing. It was wrong. Yes, it was wrong, but that's why I did it. I always had more confidence in my own judgment than I did in anyone else's. And when I returned from these unorthodox excursions, it was not safe for me to go home, for I would be confronted with all sorts of ignorant prejudice. So I used to spend the night in that little office of my father's and let the atmosphere clear it. One evening, a man was killed in a street fight in Hannibal, and the body was delivered to my father's office to be examined the next morning. The body was deposited on the floor of that little office, and I arrived home around midnight. I didn't know anything about that. I slipped in the back way and groped around until I found the sofa and laid down on it and groped around. And just as I was dropping off into the sweetest of all slumbers, which is procured by honest endeavor, then my eyes became a little more accustomed to the gloom, and it seemed I could make out the vague, dim outline of a shapeless mass stretched out there on the floor. It made me a little uncomfortable. Twain then recounted how he drifted off to sleep, but then would awake with a start, wondering what was on the floor. As the moonlight started to illuminate the floor, Twain opened one eye, and he said, in his words, "I saw a hand in the moonlight." "I sat right up," he continued, "and began to stare at that hand. I said to myself, 'Be quiet, be calm, don't lose your nerve.' Tension built up as the moonlight advanced. Twain decided to put his hands over his eyes and count to 1,000. After counting to a mere 45, he could stand no more. He took one swift glimpse. And then he said, 'I got that one glimpse, just one glimpse.' And there it was in the waxy moonlight. In that one swift glimpse, I then, well, I went away from there. I did not go in what you might call a hurry. I just went. I went right out the window. I took the curtain sash with me. I didn't need the sash, but it was handier to take it than it was to leave it." Twain humorously found out what his limit was. He found out how far he could go and how much bravery there was in him. And that introduces my topic for today. We've all gone through a tough year fueled by the pandemic. Pandemic fatigue, even pandemic burnout, is real. Unrelenting uncertainty for nearly a year and a half has taken its toll. We know from the work we do in our little company, MEK, that many companies and organizations are experiencing all kinds of challenges from this pandemic. People who are forced to work from home now don't want to go back. Fresh waves of the new Delta variant of the coronavirus hit a lot of people very hard. Our own church camps and congregations are not immune. And as a result, many of us are experiencing very real feelings of exhaustion, anxiety, and stress. Some are close to feeling burned out if they're not already there. So today, I'd like to discuss how we can deal with this from a biblical point of view. Everyone in this room and all those who are within the sound of my voice all experienced major changes in this past year. Many became virtual homeschoolers. as schools outright closed or adopted hybrid methods, in-person and virtual. Today, there's a recognized crisis from that. Many people fell behind, and return to school this year is a troublesome issue. Expanded unemployment benefits helped millions keep food on the table, but it changed how people worked. A lot of people have not come back. People speak of the great resignation that is coming. So I submit to you that many of us, including yours truly, are sick of this. I'm sick of the bad news and uncertainty that's plagued everything for over a year and a half. And during this time, we've all got mixed messages, which makes it worse. Seems like it's over, then it's not. Then there's masks, then there's not. Then it's time to be socially distanced, then it's not. Then we have multiple spikes. Things finally calm down, and then they're not. And now we have a new variant. So it's also important in this to consider that it's not just the coronavirus. McKinsey and Company, a major consulting firm, recently published an important report called The Resilience Imperative, How to Succeed in Uncertain Times. So this will give you a little example of what we're talking about. In that report is a major chart. Disruption is becoming more frequent across the board. This is not out of the Beyond Today magazine or in the telecast. This is a commercial report. And it shows how the International Monetary Fund sees uncertainty. The Federal Reserve sees uncertainty. Cybersecurity is getting worse. And interestingly enough, natural disasters have more than tripled in the past decade. It's becoming, all of this disruption is more frequent and more severe. Psychologists use a formal quantified perceived stress scale to measure the impact of stress on our lives. You can answer questions on a scale of next to nothing to very often, and ask questions, as you can read, in the past month, how often have you been upset because of something that happened unexpectedly? Or in the past month, how have you felt that you were unable to control the important things in your life? The higher the score, the worse stress you're experiencing. The more stress, the more you'll see physical and emotional and mental issues appear, unless, as we'll talk about in a minute, you take steps to deal with it. For many of us, it's more than critical. There's a major crisis as we're working with in our little company among many docs who are just burned out from all the stress of living in hospitals and dealing with this and having all the changes. Physician burnout is a very severe and important critical issue right now because when doctors make mistakes, that's a very bad thing. So it's a real thing. But there is good news. And the good news is that there's help, real help, from our Father in heaven and also our elder brother, Jesus Christ. We need to take, maybe some of you don't experience this, but most people, I think, to one degree or another, have experienced a lot of confusion and trauma. And it's not healthy for us. So how do we deal with this? So I'll discuss more in detail in a moment. We should acknowledge first that burnout and emotional stress from sustained trauma does and can and does exist. Many of us are perfectionists, and that's one of the responses. We can't do it perfectly, so we don't want to do it at all. We just fall apart. Or we become exhausted. Many of us pride ourselves on being super Christians, super parents, or super people in general. There are some people who are super people in this congregation and those in the sound of my voice. But I submit that while we are presently children of God, we are not yet God. So burnout can sneak up on us. When we're faced with a personal rock that is oversized and too big to move, we can try to rationalize ourselves around it. Sometimes we get exhibit bravado. Bring it on, we say, even though we're already burnt out. But as time wears on, stress fractures and cracks start to appear. We recently saw this up front and personal in the situation with the American gymnast at the Olympics. Simone Biles withdrew from competition in a major shock. She had asked the Wall Street Journal had published a special report interactively showing just how incredible she is. But if she has a lapse in how she presents her routines, she can have very serious injury. If you've seen that, all the double and triple leaps and twists and turns and fractions of a second, that's very unheard of. And she was the best that there ever has been, and she withdrew because of the mental pressure. She said, it's time to take care of ourselves. And she's true. It's important to realize that this current situation, which is still not over, will take a long time to resolve itself. It took a year and a half for us to get here. It'll take some time to take care of it. But what we need to now is to start to develop biblical resilience. Resilience is defined as the capacity to recover quickly from difficulties. Everyone, including all those here today, gets knocked down from time to time. I know I do, and probably more frequently in the last 12 or so months. But as Muhammad Ali once said, if you don't lose if you get knocked down. You only lose if you don't get up. So, in the honor of Mark Vincent and his comments, I'll inject some humor here. Project managers have the 7 stages of a project to help inject some humor when projects seem to be complex. Some of you have already heard them. They start out wild enthusiasm, transitions to disillusionment, goes to confusion, then to panic. Then everybody searches for the guilty. There is punishment of the innocent. And finally, there's promotion and honors for the people that weren't even involved. While this is a bit humorous, the unrelenting toxic stress produced by the pandemic is not. Burnout is a state of emotional, physical, and mental exhaustion. It's caused by excessive and prolonged stress that doesn't go away. It occurs when you feel overwhelmed, emotionally drained, and unable to meet demands. Exhaustion is tiredness and fatigue, the mental, physical, emotional, and spiritual resources that we have. Exhaustion is a major symptom. Burnout reduces productivity and saps energy. And eventually, burnout people may feel they have nothing more to give. You may or may not be in any of this, but here we'll look quickly at the 5 stages of burnout, and you can see maybe where you are. The first is the honeymoon stage, when you can do it all. There's no problem. Bring it on. I can do everything. The second is when stress starts to enter our lives. We start feeling a little tired, we feel a little overwhelmed, and these conditions start appearing. Lack of sleep, lower productivity, higher anxiety, fatigue, general neglect, grinding your teeth at night, headaches. The third stage is chronic stress. People stop working on their hobbies. They miss work deadlines. They get sick. They feel tired in the morning. Their sleep is all messed up. They get cynical. They deny they have any problems. They feel threatened. They start drinking more or doing other things. Fourth stage is actual burnout. That's when you start trying to escape. You have obsession over work. You have increased self-doubt. Have chronic headaches, stomach or bowel problems. You neglect yourself. You talk about dropping out or moving away. The final one is the 5th stage, which is the time when you should be looking at, for sure you can get help at any stage here, but this is when you really should take a look at it. That's when you have chronic clinical depression, a lot of mental fatigue, you feel tired all the time, and there is a way to deal with that. Go back, sorry. When we face times like this, when we don't see the bottom of where we are, that's when it gets really tough, when it just doesn't seem there's ever going to be an end to it. The Bible is full of stories that people have faced in this genre, including Jesus Christ himself. Jesus Christ confronted people on a regular basis. And I don't know if there are any attorneys hearing my voice, but attorneys are trained to deal with confrontation. And they also have the highest rate of alcoholism of any profession in America because they are not invulnerable to the stress. And it's important to note that all stress is not negative, but even when you have positive events that are overwhelming, those can contribute to stress even though they are good. A familiar story, of course, is the story of Elijah. Elijah is one of the great figures of the Bible. He was a great prophet, but God put him in a high stress and confrontational position. He frequently had to confront people of high standing in very unpleasant ways. As human beings, we desire approval from our peers. For many of us, it's part of who we are. Elijah didn't win any popularity contests. And this is particularly true of the famous story of Elijah versus the 45 prophets of Baal. It's a very familiar story, but we'll look at a couple of verses here in 1 Kings 18, if you want to turn there and follow along, or you can just look at the slide. Chapter 18, Elijah confronts the prophets. He's in a very adversarial position between Ahab and Jezebel. And he goes and he gathers all the people and the prophets together at Mount Carmel. And he says, how long, he says in verse 21 of chapter 18, will you go on limping between two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, follow him. And the people did not answer. So the story is familiar and it goes on. And there's some really funny things in there. Elijah totally mocks the other prophets. But then at the end, it doesn't end well for the prophets. God intervenes and answers, and it's a major miracle. And the 45 prophets are killed. And then following that, when Elijah, before all this happened, he prayed that a drought would come. And I just got back from Minnesota. I'll talk a bit more about it in a second. But it was really shocking up there when I was at SCP many, many years ago when dinosaurs roamed the earth. I used to take canoe trips in the Boundary Waters as part of the SCP. And the water was always full. There were lots of rapids and everything else. So I went up there this year. They had just closed the Boundary Waters because of a drought. And those of you on Facebook saw the photo I posted of Jamie, my wife. You saw she's standing on a lot of rocks. Those are where rapids were 2 years ago. And there's hardly any water in the river. So it was kind of amazing. So when I read this part about the rain and the drought, it kind of came home because there is one there, and of course there's one in the west. So Elijah prayed, and the drought came. And then after this major miracle, and everybody knew who God was, he prayed, and the drought ended. And that was such a powerful prayer that James himself quotes that in the book of James, verse 5 and verse 17. He isolates that prayer and notes its power. So the rain came. So Ahab, as we go on in verse 19, he goes up and tells Jezebel all about it. Jezebel doesn't have exactly what you would call a positive reaction. So after she finds out that Elijah killed the 450 prophets, she tells Elijah, or she sends a messenger to Elijah. She doesn't do it in person. She says, she curses in a very famous way in that time where she calls upon her own gods to kill her if she doesn't kill Elijah by the next day at the same time. So Elijah just had this major miracle, right? He just saw the power of God. But what happened? Well, he hit the wall. He's a mighty prophet, but he was also a human being. And his nature, as James says, was just like ours. He was afraid and he ran for his life. So the rest of the story is pretty famous about the clinical depression part of it. As you can read, it goes on for a whole chapter. And Elijah, in the next chapter, he talks to God, and they have a famous where he runs hundreds of miles away. He ends up on near Mount Sinai, and he tells God. God asks him several times about what's going on, and he says, "You know, I've served you, God, I'm out of it. You know, I'm tired. It's very hard to keep going." But God never, the interesting part about all that, and you know the story, is that God never rebukes Elijah. He never says, "Buck up." He never says, "Suck it up." He never says, "You can do it." He lets Elijah recover. And you can read that there are angels that appear. And they help him recover, they feed him, and they let him sleep. And that's part of a clinical today. Those in the healthcare profession know that that's a major part of recovery, trying to get good sleep. And it says that several times. Verse 5, he lay down and slept. He's given refreshments. So, and then remember, Elijah has a nature just like ours. So when we're burnt out and we're tired and all that, that means we need to take care of business. But one of the things that God did do at the end, as we can read in verse 16 in the next chapter, is that he told Elijah that there was an end to his confrontation, that he was to train his successor. And I imagine that was a great relief. The good news is that God will and is doing the same for us. Even in the midst of disruption, even when we're burnt out or when we're emotionally tried and we're living in a turbulent political world where it seems like there's a different story every day, God will strengthen us. It's very, very important to realize that this disruption is going on, but it's also more important that God is actively using everything to accomplish his purpose. It's also very important to remember that in the midst of all this, that he gives us the viewpoint that most people don't have, that the things that are happening to us right now will not be remembered in the long run. All the things about the Republicans and the Democrats and who's wearing a mask and who's not wearing a mask, what's happening in China, what's happening in the Southeast Asia, what's happening in the Middle East, all of this is going to be forgotten. So that should give us a perspective that we can help deal with. We also have this incredible vision that the Apostle Paul gave us in 1 Corinthians 2:9. Very familiar verse, but also very encouraging. We don't know how to perceive, we don't have the capacity to perceive what God is doing for us. Eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor neither have entered into the heart of man the things that God has prepared for us, we read in 1 Corinthians 2:9. And then we also, when we don't see an answer to things, it's important to remember a certain verse out of Romans. As Paul wrote in Romans 4, verse 18, we have to remember that God gives life to the dead and calls into existence the things that do not exist. So even though we can't see the answer, even though we can't fathom how things may work out, God already has an answer. So I'd like to take a couple of minutes here to wrap up and review a few steps to remember. And I'd also like to point out that Darris McNeely did a really great short BT Daily on this subject. It's 2 minutes long. He talks about some steps to take that are very similar and in a different direction, but complementary to what we're talking about here. So, and now you see the URL there. You can just go to ucg.org. So if we're feeling overwhelmed, what do we do? Well, we take care of ourselves. We acknowledge first that exhaustion does exist and that we can get help from God. We learn how to be nice to ourselves. We reassess ourselves. We realize that we're not Superman or Superwoman, and we try to come up with a new plan. Exercise, diet, all those things. I know that, I guess Mr. Gary Nylander told me one time that, you come up with a new plan to, for your diet and physical exercise, and it'll take 100% of the remaining joy out of your life. But there is some truth there. But we need to try different perspectives, and we need to be grateful, and we need to make a choice to try to be positive. Now, what I'm going to leave you with here is a short section in the Bible, but it packs a lot of power. It's at the end of the section in 1 Peter where Don Turgeon wrote the marriage laws about husbands and wives. I'm joking. But he speaks to everybody. So let's turn to 1 Peter chapter 3, and let's read this as we come to a conclusion. We start out in verse 8. It says, "Finally, all of you have unity of mind, sympathy, brotherly love, a tender heart, and a humble mind. Do not repay evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, bless. For this is why you are called, that you may obtain a blessing." That says a lot in a very short space. Peter was writing during a time of persecution. He was writing specifically to the people in northern Turkey, which was under Roman rule, but there's no record of the persecution there, but he does show that there was. And when he gets to this point where he's talking to everybody, the word "finally" in Greek means to sum up. It means this is what I want you to remember. This is the important part. Here's where I'm going. The phrase "unity mind" comes from the Greek word transliterated homophron, meaning harmonious. Strong's G3675, for those of you who follow that. It's a familiar theme. Paul tells us in Ephesians 4 in verses 1 and 3 that we are to walk worthy of the calling to which we have been called. We are to be eager to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace. So I submit to you, to have a mind of unity, we must do two things. First and foremost, we must believe. We must make a choice to put away doubt and believe what God says. Belief is not an emotion, although real belief can produce a calm and peaceful feeling. And second, we have to act on that belief. As James and others tell us, we must be doers of the word and not hearers only. In this spiritual framework to build resiliency, we must be sympathetic. The Greek here for sympathetic is transliterated sympathize, Strong's G4835, which means to have compassion for one another, to share in suffering, to commiserate. One of the hardest parts of being in a trial or enduring a seemingly never-ending issue is that of being alone. Reaching out a hand of support, making a phone call, dropping by for a visit, or sending a heartfelt card are all expressions of being compassionate. Going on, the Greek for brotherly love, of course, is translated Philadelphias, Strong's G5361. This is actually a commandment from Jesus Christ himself. We read John chapter 13, verse 34 every Passover, but it's something that should be part of our daily lives. It reads, "A new commandment I give to you, to love one another. Just as I have loved you, you are also to love one another." Tender-hearted or kind-hearted is a Greek word translated euspuknos. You can come closer to that than I can, I'm sure. But it represents an in-depth expression of compassion. Paul tells us in Galatians that the evidence of being kind to one another shows the Holy Spirit working within us. This represents a choice, especially when we're out in the marketplace and we're trying to get something to eat and we can't get served. We should be kind at those points because there's a labor shortage and people are overworked. Being kind-hearted is a deliberate choice. Humility of mind comes from Pinosnovne. I stepped all over that, I know. But as I said in a previous split sermon, humility is a spiritual superpower. If you're humble and you're truly humble, you're close to being invulnerable. Humility is a virtue that runs counter to much of the world today. And finally, we are told to not repay evil for evil, but on the contrary, bless. It's very easy to stir up a room or trauma on social media. It's also very easy to bite each other behind each other's backs. Doing so just intensifies everything. It solves nothing. So instead, as Peter directs, we are to bless. That simply means to convey favor. When we seek God's blessing, we are in reality seeking his divine favor. And when we bless or convey favor, marvelous things happen. Our minds shift into an attitude of gratitude. Our blood chemistry changes and great hormones help us feel better. But most importantly, when we follow this spiritual framework, Peter tells us we receive supernatural favor from God. He cites Psalm 34 to make his point. Whoever desires to love life and see good days and end to the emotional fatigue and burnout from this pandemic year, let him keep his tongue from evil and his lips from speaking deceit. That includes social media. Let him turn away from evil and do good. Speak kind words. Be kind in general. Let him seek peace and pursue it. Be a blessing to others. For the eyes of the Lord are on the righteous, and his ears are open to their prayer. So as we go forward, let us acknowledge where we are and where we're going. We're already in a good place. Let's redouble our efforts, because many people around us need help. Let's make a plan on how we can refresh ourselves, mentally, physically, emotionally, and spiritually. Let's reframe our perspectives. And in that arena, let's make sure that we believe. There's nothing too big for our God. So in closing, as we work to build up our personal resiliency, let's remember Isaiah 43 and verse 18. Remember not the former things, nor consider the things of old. Behold, I am doing a new thing, says God, and now it springs forth. Do you perceive it? I will make a way in the wilderness and rivers in the desert. All things work together for good. God is with you. Be kind and show favor.